everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a new Comics Wednesday episode for April 18th, 2018. So Nick and I are going to talk about a few of the books we think you should be keeping your eye out for when you head into your local comic shop today. Say hi to everybody, Nick.
Hey, everyone.
All right. So obviously, the elephant in the room is Action Comics 1000, first book to ever reach a 1,000. And not only is it Action Comics 1000, but it's also the 80th anniversary of Superman. So he debuted in 1938, Action Comics number one, kind of started the superhero age, if you will. And so, you know, it's appropriate that DC's making a big deal about it. Nick and I were just talking before the episode started about how many different covers there are. There's a cover for every decade. There's the regular cover. There's the blank cover, right? So that's 10. And then there's got to be, I don't know, another 10 retailer exclusives at least. I know Dan Jurgens did a retailer exclusive. Nicola Scott, Jason Fabok, George Perez, Jock did one. I think Stanley Luau, Art Germ, did one. There was another one I saw that looked really cool that was by a painter. I can't remember his name. So that's 7 right there. I'm just pulling off the top of my head. So I'm sure there's going to be – and in a way, I was like, man, it came out. I wanted to order all of them. But a lot of them are like $25 each, right? And you're talking about 10 covers plus shipping. You know, you're talking like $30. There's 10 of them. That's $300 just for a different cover. And I already ordered all 10 of the ones I could get, you know, down from my local shop. Actually, I ordered from DCBS. But so, yeah, I mean, it's a big deal. You know, obviously, I read Action Comics 1000. It's an interesting book. It's worthwhile. I'll talk about it here in a few minutes. And like I said, yeah, I ordered all 10 of the covers that I could. But I still think I'm going to go down to the midnight release. I'm curious just to see how many people show up. And the other thing about midnight release, right, is a lot of times they're allowed to sell the rest of the books too. Like DC will say, okay, yeah, you're allowed to sell, you know, all the DC titles. And then Marvel's like, oh, well, if DC's selling their books at midnight, then we want to sell our books at midnight too. And they'll just let – it's just, you know, free for all. I mean, technically it's Wednesday, right? It's Wednesday at midnight, so – books go on sale on Wednesday. So all that being said, you know, kind of by default, book of the week for me has got to be Action Comics 1000. But, there's a big but here. There's another book that I want to talk about that I really enjoyed. Kind of surprised me. It's called Skyward. And here's the interesting thing, right? Listeners of the podcast will be like, Skyward? Jace talks about that book all the time. Jeremy Dale, right? Well, not exactly. So when I heard this book announced a couple months ago in previews that there was a book called Skyward coming out from Image, it left a bad taste in my mouth a little bit. Because to me, Skyward, Jeremy Dale, you know, he passed away at a very young age. And he was a friend. And it just bothered me that there was another book coming out called Skyward. And so I didn't pay much attention. I kind of left it alone, right? And then the books came out, you know, last Friday we get our preview copies or whatever. And I looked at the cover and it's Lee Garbett. And I'm like, man, I really like Lee Garbett's art. You know, he's a good artist. And I read the solicit. And I was like, you know, this sounds kind of interesting. So despite that kind of initial dislike based on the name, I was like, let me give this a try. You know, got to try to be objective, right? So I read it, and it completely blew me away. Book of the week. Book of the week. You know, like I said, Action Comics, book of the week as well. I'm going to have co-books of the week this time, just based on the fact that Action Comics 1000 is a milestone. It's a landmark issue. You know, it's very important, and it's a piece of comic history, and it's very well done. And there's a lot of great creators in there, a lot of incredible work, a lot of great stories that capture the essence of who Superman is. And he's my favorite character. So yes, Action Comics 1000 Book of the Week, as expected. Skyward Book of the Week, as a complete and total surprise. And speaking of surprises, I read the book. I immediately reach out to the creator on Twitter, of all things, because I want to let this guy know that the book was so amazing, that it really, you know, was impactful. And right away he gets back to me like, yeah, I'd love to come on the show. So this was yesterday. This was like relatively late last night. So I want to give props to the writer, Joe Henderson. Some of you may know that name from the world of TV. He started out as a television writer, written for things like White Collars, probably one a lot of you have heard of. Currently, he's the showrunner for Lucifer. So again, I knew that after I did a little research after reading the book. And so that was part of the reason I was so surprised that he had time to talk today. So really cool that he had time, really cool that he made time. And I'm going to play the interview for you guys now.
All right, everybody. I have a special treat for you. There is a comic coming out today, April 18th, when all the new comics hit the stands. I know there's a lot of titles out there for you to pick through, but I had to reach out to this creator as soon as I read the book because it blew me away, and I want to make sure all of you get a chance to check it out. The book is called Skyward Number One. And on very short notice, I'm lucky enough to be joined by the writer, Joe Henderson. So, Joe, welcome to the Comic Source Podcast. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, man. Thank you for having me.
Like I said, I appreciate – I mean, last minute. So that's great.
I appreciate your reaction to the book. It's a labor of love and a passion project, so – having people respond to it that way was just really exciting. So thank you.
Yeah, I mean, considering how many comics I've read in my day, 35 plus years, 40.
Right.
Plus, I'm with you. Let's not talk about that. So, well, for some of our listeners who aren't familiar, why don't you give a quick intro? You know, you've been a writer for a long time, I know. So what's some of the previous work you've done?
Yeah, so I've been writing mostly in TV. I worked on a show called White Collar, and I've done a bunch of other projects. I worked on Almost Human, which was a Fox show, and 11-22-63, which was the James Franco, Stephen King miniseries, which was a lot of fun. And then I've been running Lucifer for Fox for the last 3 years. And I have written one comic previously, or at least I co-wrote a 5-page Witchblade backup story like 9 years ago. So this is I'm a long time comic reader. I was able to dip my toe way back when, and I've always wanted to actually be able to create a book and write a great big story, and this is my chance to finally do it.
Wow, that's awesome. I'm gonna have to track down that Witchblade story. Here at the Comic Source, we're big proponents of Top Cow, good friends with Matt Hawkins and
yes.
Mark Silvestri.
Oh, so Matt's great.
I'll have to track.
It's my
that
early
down.
Work, is all I'll say.
Cool. Well, let's talk about Skyward. Why don't you give our listeners a quick intro into the world and the story that you've created?
Yeah, so Skyward is a book about what would happen if, say, tomorrow, gravity on Earth became a fraction of what it is now. And so obviously it's a terrible catastrophe because, you know, if you jump too high, you just keep going. So it destroys large portions of the world and people and all this other stuff. It's a terrible catastrophe, but our story isn't about that. Our story is about 20 years later. Our story follows after humanity adapted to this new reality and not only lived, but thrived. So it's 20 years later and everyone sort of adapted to this where, you know, you can leap a tall building with a single bound. You just have to make sure you just don't jump too high and keep going. So that's sort of the fun of the book, is following a 20-year-old woman named Willa Fowler, who this is the only world she's ever known. She was born right before what we call G-Day. And so this is her normal. She loves it. She loves being able to soar through the air, and she doesn't understand how anyone actually existed in the world before this, where you were stuck on the ground and trapped and not able to fly. So it's an exploration through this world, through the lens of this woman who absolutely loves it.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that really struck me about the book was just how fun it was. Because as it starts out, you know, G-Day happens and it's this cataclysm. And really, you know, there's the drama. There's the human story for most people, right? Let's tell this, you know, yes. horrible aftermath of this. But instead, you chose to jump 20 years into the future. And as you said, humans are nothing if not adaptable. And so mm-hmm. they've adapted. They've you know, come through this. And it's like, let's tell that story. Let's tell about what happens next, right?
Yeah, I feel like we're coming out of a phase of dystopia stories, and I love dystopia stories, but I feel like we've hit that well so much that while I was playing with the story, I kind of wanted to tell a story where the world isn't really better or worse, it's just fundamentally different, where it's not, oh, this, you know, we're suffering, we're in pain, it's this is just a different normal. There are different ways to die. There are different challenges and positives and negatives. And different evils, different ways that humans can be both inspiring and terrible, and more play to that and sort of try to uncover a new story by going there.
Yeah, and another one of the things that struck me about the book was Willa's relationship with her father, Nate, which I'm sure you're going to explore more. But the little snippet we get of their interaction in the first issue kind of shows us the difference in that generational perspective, right? Like the people that remember the way the world was before, you know, seem to remember it fondly. Whereas, like you said, Willa, this is the only world she's ever known. So to her, it's probably better now, although she has curiosity previously. So that's an interesting idea there. Are you going to be exploring that throughout the run?
Very much. I mean, it's funny because you get the basic metaphor of the, in my day, the difference being for this, man, his day was very different. It actually was fundamentally different. And as you see in the first issue, he went through something very traumatic on G-Day, which has really, really affected him. And one of the things we'll learn in this upcoming issues is basically he's a man who lets fear run his life. He's to a certain extent crippled by his fear based on what happened on G-Day, whereas his daughter is this fearless being that he just can't understand. And so a large part of the story, really the heart of it, is this relationship between a fearless daughter and a father who can't understand her because all he feels is fear, and them trying to learn from each other if they survive.
Yeah, so it's interesting that you mentioned, you know, Willa being fearless. Even in the first issue, we see her take some risks. And, you know, is that the exuberance of youth? Is it because this is just the world she's grown up with? She's never known any different. I mean, as our kind of point of view character, she's really given us a unique view. And I found myself trying to put myself in her shoes and wondering, well, what would I do if I lived in that world?
Yeah, I think to a certain extent, this is so normal to her that level of danger is normal, in the same way that, you know, if she saw you running across the street and near traffic, she would be like, oh, my God, you're insane. That car might hit you. And obviously it's a little bit different. But to her, she has the self-confidence because she's lived in this world and this resourcefulness. But to me, the fun of it is such a foreign concept, but familiarizing it with the idea that, well, to her, it's not. To her, this is Tuesday.
Right. So that's got to be an interesting mental exercise as a writer, kind of a challenge. Okay, what would she actually think of as dangerous, and what is just her?
Yeah,
like you said, this is Tuesday.
Exactly. How do you do that, and how do you make it relatable? That's to me the biggest challenge, but also the fun of it is, how do you make sure that we don't feel like she's irrationally fearless, but that it's more a self-confidence based on the world? And that's been a bit of the push and pull, and honestly I think a big part of the reason that I think it works is because Lee Garbett, the artist, is so good at humanizing her. Like, his facial work is just absolutely astounding, and that's actually one of the reasons I brought him onto the book. I reached out to him about the book, I should say, he can bring a sense of humanity to these big, crazy, weird ideas.
Nice. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about Lee in a second, but one more.
I know, I'm jumping around.
No, it's totally fine. It's totally fine. But just one more about a question about Nate. We see early on when the G day happens, he is surprised, but at the same time, he's like, oh, I knew this was coming in a way, almost like I could see this happening. And then the book also ends on a cliffhanger where he seems to know more than us. So is that underlying mystery of what Nate knows, is that something that's going to be explored as well?
Yes. So that'll be the big baton that gets picked up in issue 2 and run with for a good portion of the series. The idea is that basically Nate is claiming that he's got a way to fix everything. Is Willa's dad insane? Does he have a way of doing it? And then the bigger question ends up evolving into, should we bring gravity back if we can? And one of the big things I also want to set up in this book is the sort of the arguments for and against. Her dad is a really good argument for. He lost his wife during G-Day, this terrible thing that happened to him. He doesn't want that to happen to anyone else. But then you have Edison, who is the guy she works with, who doesn't have legs from the knees down. But in this world, it doesn't matter. It's fine. He can float through the air like anyone else. So one of the things that she's going to face is this question of, is the world better or worse in either version, or is it just different?
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. Another thing that always interests me when there's mysteries presented like this in a comic medium versus TV, is that a different challenge? Do you approach it in a different way? You ended on a cliffhanger here, and another one of my favorite series of all time, Clone, by David Schulner. You know, he's a television writer, and he it's really good. I highly recommend it. But he used to always talk about trying to almost every last panel on every page be a cliffhanger. You want to make sure they turn that page. So did you find that to be a challenge as well?
Yes and no. It's like that's sort of how it's been beat into me in TV, that every act out should be a bit of a cliffhanger, and you always want that tease. And as a comic book reader, I know what gets me going, what gets me coming back. To me, the biggest challenge was making sure I have an answer for the cliffhangers or the problems. Like what I really, especially as a sort of first time name in comics, I wanted to make sure that I don't sort of basically come up with like a MacGuffin that I'm like, I'll figure this out later. One of the first things I did very early on is I figured out all the answers to all of the mysteries and all of the hooks so that I can speak to anyone who wants to listen to let them know there is an answer. It has always been the answer. It will always continue to be. I am a big fan of a lot of pop culture. And when I find out that there was no answer, they were just trying to find it, it can be very frustrating because it can often show in the work.
Right. Yeah, totally. Yeah, sometimes you watch those shows and you realize that the writers probably don't even know. It's kind of like, well, why am I wasting my time then?
Exactly. And listen, like,
the answer.
Yeah, and this is where there have been times where we haven't known exactly what the answer to something's going to be, but we knew what the area of the idea would be, and that would be enough. You're like, okay, we know their story here. We know that we have an answer. Here's a couple options. We know where we're going. But when it's like an inexplicable turn and you're like, is there any explanation for this? We'll figure it out. That gets a little scarier for me. And I like to, I like to make sure that I'm leading people down a worthy path.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned earlier working with Lee Garbett. How did you get hooked up with Lee to have him come on and help you tell this story?
So Lee was the artist on Lucifer, the comic book, which is completely unrelated to our book, other than the fact that it's the character that we sort of adapted for the TV show. And so we followed each other on Twitter, and I'm just a huge fan of his ever since Loki, Agent of Asgard, which was this awesome book with him and Al Ewing, which was just big, crazy, weird stuff, but it was so human and so grounded because he made Loki and his friends and all the other characters feel so real. And it was just this really great balance. And as I was trying to figure out what to do, I realized that's the kind of artist I needed. I needed someone who could balance the fantastical with the human. But I was also like, well, there's no way he's going to do it. Right. So I reached out to him. I'm like, hey, do you know any artists who might be interested in this? I've got 4 scripts done. Can I send them to you? And could you look at them and help me out in any way you could? And secretly, I'm hoping, please, 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 please want to do this. And I sent them to him, and he's like, hey, this looks kind of interesting. I'll read them all tonight, and I'll see who I can think of. And then I got an email the next morning. I'm in. And I was like, oh,
nice.
Oh my God. Oh my. And it was awesome. And like, we literally just have not stopped since. Like it's been one of the most amazing collaborations of my life. Because anything you throw at him, he improves. And he just has this incredible, not only skill, but work ethic. Like the dude is a monthly comic book artist while still delivering this level of stuff. He's starting on issue 7 today. So wow. We're like, we are way ahead. We're going to be monthly. We're not going to do skip months. We're like, we're on it. And a big part of that is Lee's not only a great artist, but he's a professional.
Yeah, that's cool that you're not going to do a skip month. I always worry about those, that especially for a newer title that people aren't familiar with, that it can lose momentum.
Yeah, we don't want to give any excuses for anyone to jump off. So.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder. You talked about the collaboration being so awesome. Is it? It's got to also be really beneficial for you. This is kind of your first major work, you know, as a comic book writer, and Lee's been around the block. So is he kind of mentoring you as well and kind of helping guide you with decisions and things like that?
You know, it's been great because he's been, not to toot my own horn, he's been very happy with my scripts. And mostly what he's just done is adapted them to better moments he thought of or better ways to convey something. But one of the things I did early on is I did my research. Like, I really don't like it when people come into a different medium and pretend like they know what they're doing.
Right.
I read a ton of comic scripts. I studied the craft. Mike Costa, who writes Venom for Marvel, is on the Lucifer writing staff. He's an old friend of mine. I sat down with him a bunch. I talked through the process. I studied my butt off, and I rewrote these scripts constantly. Like, I this is not like, oh, what a fun thing to do to come play in comics. Like, I want this comic to sit on my shelf, and to be in a position of pride for me. I love this story and I want to do it exactly right. So like, I came in trying to write a comic, not trying to just turn in a TV script, which can happen. Because people underestimate how hard a comic book can be and how hard writing one is. Having said all that, Lee has been very wonderful in just adding to everything that's there, and especially in character design and world building. He makes the world feel lived in, which is, to me, the biggest challenge, because it's a weird world. That's how you make it feel real.
Right, exactly. No, I totally get that. The other thing that I want to compliment you on, oftentimes the biggest, I don't know, or maybe the weakest part of a story from a first time comic writer is often the pacing. The pacing seems the hardest thing to get down. And I think the first issue was paced excellent. I mean, it was just enough to be compelling and keep you, you know, going through it. And when it ended, you wanted more. So kudos to you.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, because that was actually one of my biggest concerns, was getting that right. Because that is something that you learn over time. And as much as I've read so many books, when you actually write it, it's a whole different thing. So I really appreciate that.
Right. Well, I appreciate you coming on, as I said, Joe, on such short notice. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
The first issue is 28 pages. We filled the entire book cover to cover with story. Every issue is going to be more than 20 pages. Some are 25, some are 23. We're really trying to give bang for the buck. We know that we're asking for $3.99 out of people's pockets. So not only are we trying to tell a great story, but we're also trying to give them as much value as they can. It's a story that we love. We realize people are taking a risk on it, but we're in for the long haul, and we hope people will be too. So.
Yeah, well, I definitely recommend it, and I hope all our listeners go out there and pick it up. If anyone
Thank
wants
you.
To follow along social media so they know If you have upcoming projects or chatting about Lucifer on Twitter.
Yeah, I'm at Henderson underscore Joe on Twitter. And by the way, the last four episodes of Lucifer will be airing starting Monday. We've got a great run to a season finale, which is going to be really, really, really big. It is the biggest, craziest episode of TV we have made so far, and people will be very, very entertained.
All right, listeners, you heard it here from the man himself, so definitely go and check it out.
All right, so yeah, Joe, thanks a lot for joining. I hope the book does really well. Hopefully Joe's going to come back on when the series is over, and we'll have him talk about the experience and how the reception was and sales and all that before the trade drops, and see if he has any plans to tell more stories in this world. So they're doing really well on the book, him and Lee, as you heard in the interview. And I think he said Lee was on drawing issue 7 already. They're well ahead of schedule. There's not going to be any skip months, so the book's not going to lose any momentum at all. So again, I think it's a really great story. And let me give the complete creative team before I talk about it any further. So as I mentioned, written by Joe Henderson, the art is by Lee Garbett, the colors are by Antonio Fabella, letters by Simon Bolan. It is from Image. It's, you know, I don't think I could explain it necessarily better than Joe did in the interview there. So just suffice to say that it was a lot of fun. I love the fact that this, you know, catastrophe or cataclysm or whatever label you want to put on it, G-Day, when the gravity on Earth changed, happened. And there's a story there. And as you heard Joe say, you know, it's more of a dystopian tale in the aftermath of what happened. And he wanted to tell something, you know, a little more upbeat, a little different about human adaptability and kind of the results of what happened. So kudos to him. The book is super enjoyable. It's compelling, and I highly recommend it. So I definitely think if you're only going to get two books this week, Action Comics 1000 and Skyward. If you're only going to get one book this week, go mow a lawn or dig through your couch for spare change or check your ashtray in your car. Don't buy just one book. You got to buy both. You got to get Skyward 1 and Action Comics 1000. They're both really, really good. Now, Nick, you read Skyward as well. I'm curious to hear what your thoughts were.
Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah, I really liked it a lot. I don't know what was mentioned in the interview, but I'm a big fan of that. I mean, just some of the ways he's thinking that you wouldn't think as far as life without gravity, with, you know, the gun scene and just little details like that, or even them discovering the you can walk the crosswalk sign. I really like just the little touches like that that make it kind of a really interesting, like, dystopian future.
Yeah, through wibbly wobbly timey wimey, I will insert the interview after, so Nick hasn't actually heard it.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's you're totally right. In fact, at one point in the interview, Joe and I are talking about like the risks that Willa takes. And is that a product of the world she grew up in, or the kind of the exuberance of youth and whatever? He's talking about how it's a little bit of both. But yeah, as far as it's just what she's used to. And so she doesn't necessarily see it as a risk. He compared it to like, what if one of us was like crossing the street and there's like oncoming traffic, but we know we can make it and we like run across and we just make it, right? And she would look at us and go, what are you doing? You crazy fool. There's a car coming. You're going to get like totally run over and smashed or whatever. Cause she doesn't have that, you know, she hasn't experienced that. She doesn't have an experience that she can relate to. So us looking at the book, it's like with these, seems like she's taking these crazy risks, you know, jumping around and, you know, she could literally leave Earth's atmosphere and die in the coldness of space. So he's trying to walk that fine line between what seems like, acceptable risk to her in her world that she grew up in versus something that just seems like nobody would in their right mind would do that ever, regardless of their experiences growing up. So yeah, really, really great book, and I highly recommend it.
And it has just some beautiful shots of like panels of the city, including like a nice double spread that's very almost Spider-Man. esque to it. So
yeah,
the art too.
We talked about that as well. Lee Garbett, what he loves is the humanness and the detail of the world building that Lee brings to his art. It's often in those little details in the background and such that give the world depth and make it feel more real and more lived in, rather than, you know, some artists kind of cheat on background sometimes and it's just a flat of color. Lee's not that. He's relatively quick. You know, he's a monthly comic artist. And so for him in this day and age to put out something so detailed and so beautiful to look at on a monthly schedule is unfortunately the exception rather than the rule these days. And so, yeah, total props to him. And the colors as well. The colors are done really well. That's more of a bright color palette, which again suits the kind of the tone that Joe's trying to set here. Is, you know, even though there was this terrible event that happened and people died, this is still a fun story. I mean, them dying's not fun, but the current setting and the world and the tone is kind of bright, and Willa seems to be, you know, full of life herself and a very much positive person. So, all right, what's the first book you're going to mention, Nick?
Batman 45 by Tom King, of course, and Tony S. Daniels the art with Tame Moore as color. I don't know how to pronounce some of these people's names. I'm sorry. Yep.
I think it's Tame. Yeah. Tameu Moore. Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, it's the gift. You know, it's going to be the big wedding one, only it isn't, which is awesome. It's actually got like an old school type cover that is a little cheesy, but I like it a lot. If you're looking at the original cover, the old Booster Gold Must Die, which makes me think of Spock Must Die or any of that type stuff, which is fun. Now, how much do we want me to talk about the story?
Well, don't spoil because, you know, people probably are on their way to the comic shop right now as they're listening. So just usually we give our overall impressions. And, you know, as long as you're not giving away any cliffhangers or you know, intricate details. Just your overall what you thought of the book and anything really stood out to you.
Cool. And I can talk about the cover a little bit.
Yeah, walk that fine line.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I like it because it's a It's a little bit of a departure from what the comic's been recently, where it's kind of been, you know, setting up the big wedding and everything. It's what to say about it? It's kind of back to a more traditional Batman story, if you were, with a very recent type of. I don't know how little to say about it.
No, just go ahead. Give us your thoughts.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's all about Booster Gold. He's just trying to give Batman his wedding gift, you know, because it's been going on between Selina Kyle and Bruce Wayne for a while. They're going to get married. We've seen a lot of fun issues, kind of just like last time it was all about Selina Kyle, like getting a wedding dress. And that was a lot of fun. They've had some light ones, like with Batman, Superman, and Lois Lane and Selina Kyle all going to the carnival together and switching outfits, which I really like that one a lot. This one kind of gets back to kind of classic Batman, but also it's a little bit of an alternate. Things are a little off in this story.
Yeah, I mean, isn't Booster, like Booster's trying to let Batman know? I haven't read it, but
yeah.
Isn't Booster like trying to like show
Batman looking for Batman to show him the gift that he got him for his wedding.
Right, and doesn't that have to do with like his, what if his parents lived or something like that?
There's a flash pointiness to it.
Okay.
One could say. But it's interesting to see another, like, I mean, it's always fun to see alternate dimension old types, like what if stories or just however they play it out. But it lets you kind of see, I don't know, it's a different look at Gotham and all the members of the Bat family.
Yeah, it sounds good. I'm a little behind on Batman. I haven't read this one yet. But I'm a fan of Booster Gold, fan of alternate history kind of thing. So, but I imagine it doesn't go quite the way Booster expected. Is that kind of how the story plays out?
Yes, exactly. He's all excited to be there. And I don't know. And of course, his little robot friend. Skeets. How was his name? Skeeter or something?
Skeets.
Skeets. Yeah, because I've read a few comics with Booster Gold, but not that many. Like, I think I read a Batmite issue that had Booster Gold in it or something years ago. But there's some great chemistry between Skeets and Booster Gold that makes the first part of it kind of funny, and then it kind of like it starts to get a little bit more serious. And
yeah, we'll remedy your lack of Booster Gold knowledge, because the original Dan Jurgens first 25 issues is classic must read DC goodness. One thing I want to mention about the book, so the variant cover by Jim Lee is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Did you notice though that what a departure it is? And I believe this is starting like this month, with the lack of trade dress. So, you know, normally, even though it's a variant cover, it still has the same trade dress. So you still see the big Batman logo. You still see DC Universe 45, you know, and so it covers up a significant portion of the artwork, just like on a regular cover. I want to say it's starting this week, because I don't remember seeing any variant covers last week that went this direction. But it's the Jim Lee book or the Jim Lee variant cover. It's like his art is almost like virgin, right? It's almost without anything overlaying the art. There's a small box in the lower left that says 80 years of Superman. And then in small type along the bottom right corner, Batman 45, King Daniel Morey, rated T for teen, DCComics.com. So very small. And I love – if this is what they're going to do for their variant covers going forward, I am all for it, man. The fact that you get more of the art. Because when you look at that art by Jim Lee, if you put the regular Batman logo there, you got to do one of two things, right? Either move the whole image down and crop off like the bottom there where Batman's like crouching on the building, or you're covering up the bat signal that's in the sky. So I think this is how they're going to do their variant covers going forward. So I just wanted to point that out. I think it's a really, really neat idea. And I would go so far as to say, do all the covers like that. I know they probably won't, because you still want the logo. It's kind of hard to tell. I mean, it is written kind of small, you know, Batman 45, but variants tend to be more for hardcore comic readers. They seem to be the ones that kind of pay attention and pick them up. So I don't think that you need a logo that says Batman. Whereas if it's just your average person in off the street has heard, oh, Batman's getting married, and they're going to go in there and look at the comic rack, you kind of need that Batman logo there to say, hey, this is Batman. This is what you're looking for. So I just wanted to point that out. Had you noticed that when you looked at the digital copy that we got for review?
Yeah, I thought it was weird that it was like that. I didn't realize. I just thought maybe it was something to do with digital copies, since I'm usually get my books physical.
Yeah, well, and that very well may be the case sometimes. Like sometimes we'll get review copies that aren't like the final artwork, or you get them and they're black and white, or it doesn't have any trade dress on there at all. There's like no words or anything on the front cover. It's just the image, because they haven't basically finished it yet. But from what I understand, I believe I saw on Twitter some of the creators talking about the fact that this is kind of the new way they're going to do variants. So I just wanted to point that out. Really excited about that. All right. I guess I should talk about Action Comics 1000 now. I'm wondering if, as I flip through all the hundreds of, see, here's the thing, right? It doesn't have, because it's a bunch of different stories, it doesn't necessarily have a creator, like it's not in the beginning where it says, oh, here's all the creators that are in Action Comics 1000. So let me do a quick search, because I don't want to leave anybody out. I'm just wondering if I can. Okay, I think if I go here to the Action Comics 1000 page on DC Comics. Yep. Okay, so Brian Michael Bendis, John Cassaday, Olivier Coppiel, Paul Dini, Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, Patrick Gleason, Butch Geis, Jeff Johns, Dan Jurgens, Tom King, Jim Lee, Clay Mann, Brad Meltzer, Jerry Ordway, Tim Sale, Louise Simonson, Scott Snyder, Kurt Swan, Peter J. Tomasi, Marv Wolfman, Steve Rood, Michael Choi, Dave Gibbons, Mike Allred, Jim Steranko, Joshua Middleton, Dan Juergens, Lee Bermejo, Richard Donner, Norm Ratman, and if there's anybody else that I'm leaving out, I apologize. And if I come across another name, oh, Hi-Fi Design. They did colors on it. So it's really a kind of a who's who of creative talent. And when they do books like this, I love that they kind of go all out and get so many people involved. One of my favorite comics of all time is actually Action Comics 400. No, it's Superman 400. And it's kind of the same way where they have like so many different creators working on it. They're named on the cover. I mean, some of these same creators, Jim Steranko, Mark Wolfman. And so I love it when it's like this jam session of all these different creators. Now, one thing that that they did in Superman 400, I wish they'd done here is a bunch of pinups. But I guess in lieu of that, that's why we have all those different variant covers. Whereas, you know, Superman 400 just has the one cover and then there's pinups inside. So I guess that's kind of the difference there. So, oh, and I should mention, so Hi-Fi Design is Brian and Christy Miller, just to put some names there. So I'm just going to go through real quick, and because it is an 80-page giant and there are a bunch of different stories, I'm going to go through and kind of tell you which creators worked on which story and kind of what the theme of the story is about. I'm not going to get into any details or anything. But the first story leading off is From the City That Has Everything, written by Dan Juergens, Norm Ratman on inks. Juergens wrote and penciled it, actually. Norm Ratman on inks and then Hi-Fi on color, as I said, Brian and Christy Miller. And Superman's repelling this Kund invasion. But what he really – what Lois and the rest of Metropolis really want him to be doing is showing up for this Superman Appreciation Day to kind of allow the city that's kind of adopted him as their own to kind of thank him for everything he's done. And I don't want to say more than that because there's a lot more to it. But it ends up being pretty impactful, and it's just a really good way for Juergens to kind of say goodbye to the character. I mean, I know there's an Action Comic special coming out that kind of wraps up his storyline, but I feel like this is a good ending place. I know Juergens had more stories to tell with Superman, but then, you know, Bendis came over from Marvel and decided he wanted to Superman, and I'm excited for that because it's a new writer, somebody talented who's going to take Superman in a new direction, hopefully. Be excited, but man, I'm also saddened that Juergens is leaving the book because he's done so great. And since Rebirth, Superman has really been so high quality and telling such great stories. And I'm a firm believer, and I saw Dan Didio actually say the same thing recently in an interview, but I've been saying it for years, not that Dan stole it from me or anything, but it's that as goes Superman, so goes the DC Universe. And that's not to say that Superman books need to be the best-selling titles at DC in order for the rest of their books to sell well. But when the stories are good and the quality is high on Superman, it seems like the entire DC universe takes its cue from that in a way. And it seems like they do pretty well. And they have been doing pretty well recently since Rebirth starts. I mean, not everything is great. There's some titles that are kind of duds or stinkers or just aren't particularly good or maybe boring or not as good as they could be. I mean, there are problems. Don't get me wrong. But Superman and Action Comics, for the most part, haven't been part of the problem at all. And for that reason, I would have liked to have seen Juergens continue. But as I said, I'm also curious to see what Brian Michael Bendis does. And I hope he doesn't screw it up. I really hope he doesn't throw the baby out with the bathwater and change too much of the status quo as far as, you know, Lois and John and things like that. I know he's going to be focusing a lot on the supporting cast too, which may be the one part of the story that hasn't been focused on a lot. I mean, we haven't gotten a lot of supporting cast, some, but not a lot. And it seemed like back in the heydays, the Triangle era of the 90s, when Superman was basically a weekly title, that we got a lot of supporting character moments. So hopefully that comes back. Anyway, back to Action Comics 1000. The second story deals with Vandal Savage, and he basically traps Superman in a loop through time. And thinks that he'll never see him again. And it's kind of a way for, even though this Superman supposedly didn't come on the scene until much later, it's a way to go back and visit all the previous eras of Superman. So it's basically a story told in one-page pinups, starting back in the 30s and moving forward in time. And it's done really, really well. A lot of incredible images. Like I said, they're all splash pages. And props to Patrick Gleason, the artist. He really changes his style to suit the particular time period of the pinup. Incredible job. Like when I was reading it, I was very curious to know who the artist was because it wasn't readily apparent to me that it was the same artist. Like that's how much the style was changing to suit the particular time period, whether that be World War II or the 90s or whatever it was. So great job by Patrick Gleason. And he was working with his longtime partner, Peter J. Tomasi. So that's the creative team on the Superman book that's been so good lately. And the colors on that were handled by Alejandro Sanchez. Next up, we have The Enemy Within. It's from a script by Marv Wolfman with art by Kurt Swan. Yes, the Kurt Swan. Never before published Kurt Swan art, who for a long generation of Americans is the consummate Superman artist. When they picture Superman in their head, they're picturing the art of Kurt Swan. Kurt Swan, Jose Luis Garcia Lopez. Those are the two big ones that you'll hear about because a lot of their art appeared on like commercial t-shirts and sheets and toys and, you know, you name it. Superman merchandise. These were the two artists. Kurt Swan for a long time and then toward the end of the 70s, Garcia Lopez. So they found this art and didn't really have anywhere to put it, didn't really have a story for it. Marv Wolfman came in, came up with the story. Superman himself doesn't appear in the story except for one page, and a page that's actually not drawn by Kurt Swan. And he created a story that makes sense and has Superman involved, even though he's not like physically there in Metropolis. So really, really incredible job. And the inks are by Butch Geis, and the colors are by Hi-Fi. All right, the next story is an interesting one. It's Superman and Lex Luthor, very much harkening back to the 70s with how they just don't get along and, you know, much different than the current state of affairs with Luthor and Superman, which I think is one of the first things Bendis is going to change, actually. But it's by Paul Levitz and Neil Adams. And Neil Adams handles the art, and the colors are by Hi-Fi. And it's Superman and Lex Luthor playing chess, and that's all I'm going to say. And it was interesting. Incredible art by Neil Adams. Really, really awesome job. The next story in the book is The Car by Jeff Johns and Richard Donner. Yes, that Richard Donner, the Richard Donner who made you believe a man could fly in Superman the movie in 1979. The art is by Olivier Coppiel, who many feel is the greatest living comic artist right now. It's set back in the 30s. It's very much an emotional piece. And it's about a guy who has made some poor choices in his life. And Superman inspires him. I'll say it that way. So it's really, really well done. And I've got to give props. The colors on this are also by Alejandro Sanchez. And he really shows the importance of a colorist in a story. Because the colors here are so vastly different from the way he colored the previous piece. The Vandal Savage Superman story, and it really suits this story, and it's nice to see him have that kind of versatility. The next story in the book is called The Fifth Season, also a Lex Luthor and Superman tale, kind of thinking back to their childhood together in Smallville. It's called The Fifth Season, Scott Snyder scripting, Raphael Albuquerque on art, and Dave McKeag on colors. Next up, we have Tom King and artist Clay Mann with colors by the incomparable Jordi Belair. DC Comics presents Of Tomorrow. And this was a story that they actually released early and let a lot of people take a look at. Incredible art by Clay Mann. He's probably in my top three artists whose art I love, who I do not have an original piece from. I really need to remedy that. Although, as I say that, I realize I do have a quick Ninjak head sketch. But I need something a little more detailed than that from him. I will obtain it at some point. But it's basically Superman at not the end of time, but the Earth is no longer inhabitable. And he's gone back to visit the grave of his parents. And it's very powerful and very, very moving. Next up, we have 5 Minutes, written by Louise Simonson and Jerry Ordway. So these are two of the creators that were a big part of the Triangle era of Superman in the 90s. And this story very much felt like it belonged right in that era. And it was a lot of fun for fans who were following that ride, that weekly Superman book, following the Triangle issues. You'll enjoy this one for sure. It's a heck of a lot of fun. And Jerry Ordway, man, he is one heck of a Superman artist. And I wish that he was on a Superman title now, actually. He's that good. And I know recently he was looking for work. So I hope you're listening, DC. Get him on a Superman title quick. Next up, we have Action Land. This is from a script by Paul Dini with pencils by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez. Real treat here. You know, Garcia Lopez is in his 70s now, so I don't know how much more work we have coming from him. But this was a lot of fun. Has to do with Mr. Mixia's Pidalic. And yeah, fun is just the best way to sum it up. Next, we had one of my favorite stories from the book, Brad Meltzer, art by John Cassaday, colors by Laura Martin, Faster Than a Speeding Bullet. And again, a story, you know, 3-4 pages that shows that Meltzer really gets who Superman is. And it's all about hope. It's all about inspiration and not necessarily from flowing in one direction, right? It's not just Superman inspiring. It's Superman being inspired by the other citizens of Metropolis. And then finally, the one everyone's been waiting for, The Truth by Brian Michael Bendis, pencils by Jim Lee, inks by Scott Williams, colors by Alex Sinclair. And this sets up Superman going forward, right? It's Superman fighting this new villain. Incredible kinetic Jim Lee art with all that detail that you'd come to expect. A knockdown drag out. We don't have a lot of information about this new villain, but the last panel, holy cow. I think a lot of people, when they see that last page and they hear what this new villain has to say, it's a game changer. It's a game changer if what he's saying is true. I mean, we're talking about changing something fundamental that has been the same for 80 years of DC history since the origin of Superman was told. So Brian Michael Bendis is making a statement. He's definitely, you know, trying to plant his flag. So Action Comics 1000, there's a lot there. And, you know, pre-ordered over 500,000 copies were pre-ordered. So, you know, it's going to be one of the top titles of the year. Everyone's going to be talking about it for the next couple of weeks. So do yourself a favor. Be sure you pick up a copy. And I think a lot of places are going to be selling out. I'm sure DC, knowing that 500,000 pre-ordered, it wouldn't surprise me if they printed 1 million copies. But it could still sell out. I mean, it's gotten a lot of mainstream news coverage. So there's going to be a lot of people that are going to be paying attention, and not just comic fans, right? Like just your average fans. Superman 1000, it's a landmark for sure. So, all right, what do you have up next, Nick?
Well, I have something just as exciting as that. And that's Dead Man number 6 by Neil Adams. Neil Adams and Neil Adams doing everything, I suppose. It's a complicated book. Say that.
Yeah, can you tell me? I'm not even exactly sure. What is that 6-issue miniseries even about?
It's about Dead Man learning about his more factors about his death and his family.
Okay.
And how they're tied to like the League of Assassins. Like pretty early in the series, it might not be true, but he learns that his mom was dying before he was born or his siblings were born. So like Ra's al Ghul came along and was like, you guys want to use the Lazarus Pit. And for that price, they owe their children or something. And his older brother has been sent to the League of Assassins. And it's confusing. So I don't remember all the details. He was shot for some reason due to his brother being sent or not. And his sister was also sent somewhere. Because the parents owed this debt to Ra's al Ghul.
Okay, because I remember when it was announced, Neil Adams was talking about how, yeah, this is a complete game changer for Dead Man. He's going to be adding to the origin of him, and nothing's ever going to be the same. Problem is, Dead Man's not really a super well-known character. So, I mean, it's cool that he's adding to his tale, right? and hopefully some other writers, maybe people who are a little better at writing than Neil Adams.
That's why I was excited to read it. Not Neil Adams, but I mean, like we've said, I've only been reading comics since like 2011 or so. But that was when like New 52 started, and one of my favorite titles was always Justice League Dark. And Dead Man was a big part of that. And we obviously see a lot of other characters like Zatanna pop up and our Zatanna pop up in this book. So that's why I was interested to read more about the character. Knowing, yeah, mostly him, Constantine, there's a little specter in my past, so.
Right on. So, I mean, did you enjoy it overall, or is it one of those that you think you need to go back and give it a reread?
I definitely need a reread. It's little, it has not the ending you expect, and kind of just sets up another book in a way, more than give you like an ending also. Right. So it was kind of an odd, like suddenly, oh, it's, that was it. And it didn't really help me explain anything. So
yeah, you just wonder if Adams is hoping the sales, you know, kind of allow for another, you know, like he can go to DC and say, look at how well this sold. Give me another so I can keep telling this tale. The problem is, I love Neil Adams' art. Don't get me wrong. I love the guy's art. He's not, for me, he's hot and cold, like when to actually meet him in person. Sometimes he's like in a super great mood and super awesome to meet, and other times he seems tired and grouchy and standoffish. But, you know, that everybody has good days and bad days. I'm not going to judge a guy for that. And his art's incredible. I love his art. And here's the thing about his art, right? Like, I forget how good it is until I go and pick up a Neil Adams book, like the Neil Adams story in Action Comics 1000. I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember why this guy's a master for sure when I check out his art. So, you know, dynamic and emotional. But anytime I read anything the guy writes, it's the pacing, 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 pacing. It's one of the hardest things to get right as a comic writer. But Adams has been in comics forever. Now, granted, he hasn't written that many, and so maybe he's still trying to learn. And it may be that he's just so stubborn, he's just going to tell the stories the way he wants to tell them. And the pacing, it's always the pacing. I find myself flipping back and going, wait, what? It seems like there's chunks missing out of the story sometimes, and it's just – I don't know. I mean, I do want to read that Dead Man book. I did pick up issue one and start to read it, and got a little confused, was super tired. I was like, I need to read this when I'm fully awake. Flipped through some subsequent issues, but I haven't read it. I do want to read it. I am a big fan of Dead Man.
And the art's part of what drew me to it as well when I was reading the first issue. But, like, I mean, I read books like Hellblazer – and stuff like that. And it's never as confusing as the names they throw at you here and the mythology they throw at you here. Like, I've read Swamp Thing. I've read all this good stuff, but it's like so complicated.
That's the thing. But that's the thing with Adams too. Like, he'll throw concepts in there that you're probably reading it going, oh, well, if I knew more about the DC history and mythology, I would understand this. No, don't blame yourself, man. Don't blame yourself. Adams is just inventing people. He's just inventing people and putting names in there and expecting you to know who they are. He does that. He's just like talking about things that happened in the past that you should totally know and understand. And you find yourself thinking, oh, did I miss an issue? Or did – no, it's the first issue. Like, and that's the problem I have with his writing. He just – yeah, it's tough. I think any book he writes, any series he writes, it's a double read for sure just to try to get what you can out of it. And there's still going to be questions like, huh, what?
And it's interesting that maybe it's not selling that well because the book that it says is a follow-up book is not titled Dead Man anymore. It's titled Batman something, even though there's been very little interaction with Bruce Wayne in this book.
What's it called? Batman what?
Batman Demigods War.
Huh.
So stand by for book two, Batman Demigods War.
Well,
so
maybe DC's like, you know what'll sell? Neil Adams drawing Dead Man. You know, it didn't sell that great. The art was good, but Neil Adams writing not so good. Sales weren't always there. You know what'll sell? If we do Dead Man and put Batman in. Everybody loves when Neil Adams draws Batman. Let's put Batman in it. Everybody loves Batman. Just put Batman in a book and it'll sell. Doesn't matter how bad the story is.
It's kind of true with the amount of Batman miniseries that are out one time.
He's DC's answer to Deadpool. Just, you want some sales, you need a bump. Dan Didio needs to go on vacation, needs a little more pocket money. Put out another Batman book. or Jim Lee. Jim Lee's, you know, in Europe right now, and he's a little walking around money. Just put out another Batman book. People will pre-order it. Don't worry.
Well, do you, you said you don't watch really the Marvel movies. Have you watched, do you watch any of the DC animated at all?
No. At any point? No, just but if, are you going to ask about Batman Brave and the Bold?
No, I was going to say that just the Justice League Dark book, video felt kind of like that. It worked, but it was like, but Batman's never involved in any of the New 52 books, but Batman was one of the main characters.
Oh, was he?
In the video. And he, like, it's almost all about him and Constantine bouncing off each other, yeah, which is a lot of fun. But there was never any Batman present in the New 52 book, Justice League Dark. It was just like, now, yeah, how do we sell this Blu-ray?
Yeah, here's the thing about the DC animated movies. I buy them all, but I did never make time to watch them. And in fact, I think I stopped. I don't think I've bought the last few, just because I wasn't like, but I like all the early ones, Green Lantern, Emerald Knights, and All-Star Superman. Like, yeah, I bought them all. I have them all, but I haven't watched them. I can't remember if I, is Justice League Dark, that wasn't the most recent one, right?
No, that was even like 2 years ago, I think.
I think the last one I bought before I was like, I got to stop buying these because I haven't watched any of them, which isn't true. I've watched the first few. I think the last one I bought was the Suicide Squad one.
Oh, the first Suicide Squad one?
Yeah, the first
one. Yeah, I think it was after that. Yeah. But it was their second R-rated one after Killing Joke.
But I did...
So they actually go for the violence and stuff in it.
I definitely haven't seen it. I definitely haven't seen them. Yeah, I think I was buying them all. I got that last, or the first Suicide Squad one. And then actually I did buy the Teen Titans, Judas Contract. I did buy that one also. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that one. I've watched that one just because I was a big fan of that story. But yeah,
even the actor who does Constantine on that is just, I don't know. He's from the NBC TV series. He's going to be a Legends of Tomorrow now also.
Yeah, he was on Legends of Tomorrow this last season, wasn't he? Matt Ryan?
Yeah, he was on 3 episodes. Yeah, he's. I think he's the best, most accurate cast comic book character, I think, from DC or Marvel. He reads it. Every time I read Constantine on Justice League Dark, he's in my head.
Yeah. Is his name Matt Ryan? Matt something.
Yeah, right? Matt Ryan. Yep.
Okay. I was going to say, because isn't that the name of the quarterback from like the Atlanta Falcons?
Yeah, I learned that pretty fast after tweeting about Matt Ryan.
Whoop, wrong Matt Ryan.
I've been writing about him on LRM. Someone's like, you mean the quarterback? And I'm like, no.
All right. Well, next up, I'm going to talk about Brave and the Bold number 3. Speaking of Batman and animated, this is not the Batman animated cartoon. Brave and the Bold, classic 200-issue series from DC back in the day. And it was, I think, from issue about 50 on, it was always Batman and him teaming up with someone, right? So one month it would be Batman Green Arrow. Next month it would be Batman Zatanna. Next month it would be Batman Elongated Man. And then they had the super cool cartoon and the video game for the Nintendo Wii, Batman Brave and the Bold. And now we've got Liam Sharp doing The Brave and the Bold, Batman and Wonder Woman. So still borrowing on that name because it is a Batman team up. But, you know, Liam Sharp coming off his critically acclaimed return to comics with Wonder Woman in the Rebirth era. And not only is he an incredible artist, but, you know, he's a good writer as well. And so he decided to kind of take on these old Celtic myths and involve Wonder Woman in that. And she in turn involves Batman. Plus Batman is tied in another way through something that's going on in, I think they call it Irish Town or the Irish Quarter of Gotham City. And so there's so much here. It's very much a bit of a dense read just based on the fact that there's a lot of Celtic names and Celtic terms and Celtic folklore in there. And so you can get pretty in depth in this book. You could do a little research and really fall down the rabbit hole and get a lot of bang for your buck as far as entertainment value out of this book. But you don't necessarily have to. You can just read it. It's still easy to understand what's going on. It is a little bit of a more dense read, but it suits the story that Liam is telling, and his art suits that as well, because his art, to me, always has a very much of a fine art feel. Like if there's any comic artist that's working in the medium today where I would say, it's not comic art, man. It's just art. I would put Liam Sharp art up against any kind of fine art, you know, artists working today in you know, oil painting or working in graphite or whatever. I mean, the guy's art is just absolutely incredible. So much detail, so much expression. It's beautiful to look at. And he's doing a lot of really cool things with the way he's laying out the panels on the pages and, you know, borrowing from these Celtic ideas with the way he's framing the panels. And I mean, I just can't imagine the amount of work that this guy's putting in. I don't know when he's sleeping. It's absolutely incredible. And do yourself a favor, check it out. I think it's the best work I've seen Liam do. And that's saying something because his work on Wonder Woman was pretty darn good. So as I said, Liam is writing the story. He's handling the artwork. And the colors are by Romulo Fajardo Jr., who did a lot of the colors on Wonder Woman, actually with the other Wonder Woman artist, Nicola Scott. And Laura Martin was working with Liam. But on this book, it's Fajardo Jr., and he's doing a great job with the color palettes. A lot of purples, a lot of greens, a lot of browns. So very much in keeping with that Celtic theme. And man, just flipping through the pages here, it's like, it's a lot of like giant, I don't want to say splash pages, but it's like art that's framed by the natural boundaries of the page with a lot of insets. And what it allows him to do is draw all these little intricate details around these splash pages. And yeah, I mean, the art is incredible. You look at some of these scenes with foliage in the forest. Oh my God, it must take him forever. I mean, he's drawing every leaf individually practically. It's incredible art. And the story's really cool too. Just to give real quick, because I don't want to give away details because I want you guys to go out there and read it. But it's basically the story of this kind of different fairy dimension of Celtic myth. And there's two traditional kind of enemy races that are trapped there. And when they were on Earth, they were always at war, and now they're trying to learn to get along living in this realm. And one of their rulers is killed, and they're on the brink of war, and kind of their caretaker, the caretaker of the land that they now live in, reaches out to Wonder Woman to be a peacekeeper. And Wonder Woman thinks to herself, okay, murder? Mystery? I need a detective? Let me get Batman. And so that's how Batman enters the story. But as I said, there's also a tie-in with something that's going on in the Irish quarter of Gotham City that I'm sure we'll learn more about. So I think this is a 5 or maybe a 6-issue series. Actually, I think it's on the cover. Let me just take a quick peek. Yeah, 6-issue miniseries, and this is number 3 of 6. So really, really good story. But if there were no words and no story, I'd buy this just for the Liam Sharp art. That's how good it is. So check it out, definitely. What do you have up next, Nick?
I have Cave Carson Has an Interstellar Eye by John Rivera with art by Michael Avon Oeming and colors by Nick Flaherty. I don't know any of these names. I'm learning. It's issue 2. I've been seeing ads for a while for the Cave Carson Has a what's the other one? This seems like to be a new series based on that one. I don't remember what do you remember what the other one's called?
Cybernetica.
I'm spacing it. Okay, yeah. So this is actually, I guess, a continuation of that, maybe. This is actually my first foray into either title. So this was a fun experience. But I have been seeing the ads in my other DC comics for a while, and I've never really even experienced the Young Animal imprint or anything yet, or whatever that is, but I've always kind of been attracted to it, even looking at the cover to this one and then the art inside, which matches, and all the ads I've seen for it. It has a very almost Adult Swim look to it, yeah. The Adult Swim of comic books, and it very much is that, this title, I would say. It very much reminds me of like The Real Adventures of Johnny Quest or like Venture Brothers or something along those lines. Yeah. I mean, the title of this arc is called, or issue is Destiny of the Laser Monks, Part 1. So that's very much a really fun, goofy book.
Yeah, I'm glad you wanted to check it out. I've wanted to check out Cave Carson. I think I have the first few issues, and then probably the subsequent ones digitally. But, you know, I there's only so many hours in a day and only so many books I can read, right? And Cave Carson, very much like a third or fourth tier character in DC, and I'm always interested in reading about those characters that you don't know a lot about, because it's often more interesting in a way, because the creators on those books, nobody's really looking, right? Nobody's looking to see if somebody screwed up Cave Carson's continuity. You know, it doesn't matter because Cave Carson's not an internationally known icon. You know, whereas if you're working on Superman or the X-Men or Spider-Man or Batman, you know, the eyes are on you to make sure that you're not damaging this money-making icon for these multinational companies, right? You do something like Cave Carson, Moon Knight, whatever you want to do, right? Sky's the limit. So I'm glad you decided to check it out. Are you going to keep reading?
Oh, absolutely. And I need to find the last one, I guess. The first – this begins a new storyline, but it's Intergalactic Eye number 2.
Which, yeah,
I don't know what that even means.
I'll have to see if I can hunt those down for you. All right. Well, next
book. Yeah.
The next book I'm going to talk about is Damage number 4. I'm just going to talk about this one real briefly because I've talked about every issue of Damage that's come out so far. Part of the reason I was doing that is because Manny just didn't like the first issue so much, even though every time I say that, he goes, no, I liked it fine. I'm like, then why did you say when we reviewed it, you didn't like it? He said it was too much like the Hulk, right? So part of the reason I review this every time is because it's by my best writer of 2017, Robert Venditti. And it was Tony Daniel on art up through issue 3. But now with issue 4, we have Kerry Nord coming on, and colors are by Tameo Moore. And let me just say real quick that the creative team of Venditti and Nord, that was the team that relaunched Exo Manowar for Valiant Comics in 2012. So I actually talked to Robert Venditti recently, just this last Saturday. He came on for over an hour and talked about his new title, Hawkman, that's coming out. And you guys will be able to hear that interview on Friday's episode, April 20th. So be sure to be on the lookout for that. But I did ask him before we kind of dove deep into Hawkman about teaming up with Kerry again and if it was like coming home. And he was very complimentary and talked about the fact that him and Kerry get along very well and they have the similar sensibilities. And it was a lot of fun to have him back on the book. So it's a very much a different feel with Kerry Nord on the book as opposed to Tony Daniel. But being that it's now Poison Ivy entering the book as the antagonist for Damage, it works because Nord has much more of an organic style. It's not quite as clean as Tony Daniel. So as I said, it works. One thing that's different as well about this book, this particular issue of this story, is it doesn't give us a lot in the way of continuing the feel of Ethan Avery or Damage being on the run, right? I mean, up to this point, it's been his pursuers have been breathing right down the back of his neck, and it was very much that man on the run kind of feel. He's got a little bit of breathing room here, and so it's cool to see Rob kind of allow the story to kind of breathe and us to get more of a sense of how powerful Damage is and who Ethan Avery is. And I think that's partially the reason for this a little bit of a change of pace of story, because we see that there are people threatened by Poison Ivy's appearance and what she's trying to do. And it'd be real easy for Ethan, especially based on the fact that he is being pursued by the U.S. military and the Justice League, to kind of be like, that's not my problem, but that's not what he does. And so, again, I think that's part of the motivation for Venditti telling the story that he's telling. So, continues to be a really, really good book. I think Venditti's a great writer, as I've been saying for years now, if not longer. So, definitely check out Damage number 4. What do you have up next, Nick?
The only I think that's all I had time to read this week. I just did want to mention I wasn't able to read a copy of it yet. Tales of Suspense 104 comes out this week, which is the conclusion of the Red Ledger storyline with Hawkeye and the Winter Soldier by Matthew Rosenberg and art by Travel Foreman. I'm looking forward to reading it to myself. I haven't read it yet, but it's been a good 4-issue storyline so far. I think it's going to probably switch characters after that. So it's good to hop on before this particular duo was done with their run. So
I have a couple more I'm going to mention relatively quickly. You know, we've been talking about Mr. Miracle on the podcast ever since it came out. Actually, before it came out, Manny was telling everybody, pre-order this book, pre-order this book. I mean, as soon as we heard it was Tom King and Mitch Gerrits on Mr. Miracle, we were telling you guys, pre-order the book. And still, somehow it managed to fly under people's radar. And we've had like, I don't know, 4 or 5 printings of issue 1, 3 or 4 printings of issue 2. Like, it keeps selling out as more and more people hear about it and jump on it. And it's like, I'm not trying to be like an I told you so and a know-it-all, but man, we told you guys that this was going to be really good. And, you know, just based on the quality of creators, Tom King, Mitch Gerrits, loved experimenting and telling stories in new ways. And the reason I wanted to mention it, even though we've talked about it ad nauseum, how incredible it is because I saw a Twitter feed this last week of somebody complaining about, you know, here I am spending $4 on a comic and there's like 21 panels that are just black that say Darkseid is. Or it's Mitch Gerrits repeating the same art with only slight changes for like 9 straight panels. Or maybe 6 panels and then only the last 3 panels have different changes. And why am I paying $4.99 for this book? And, you know, I'm getting cheated. And the thing that really bugged me about it was the fact the guy was putting hashtag King and Gerrits don't care. And he was like, why should I care? They don't care. Clearly they don't care. Man, you could not be farther from the truth. I know these guys personally. They care so, so much. They're trying something different. They're trying something new. It's part of the reason the book is doing as well as it is. If you want to go see superheroes, you know, fighting and traditional comics, you know, superhero comics or whatever, man, there's tons of titles out there. Go pick up Superman 1000. Check out the Brian Michael Bendis Jim Lee story. Go check out Damage number 4. There's plenty of titles out there for you to go and get that. They're trying to do something different, right? I'm sorry that you don't like the fact that issue 8 is partially about Mr. Miracle and Big Barda juggling their roles as rulers of New Genesis and being at war with Apocalypse and trading off weeks. One stays home and takes care of the baby. The other one is at war. And then they switch, right? That's interesting to me. I can relate to that. You know, us real people relate to that. We often have to do that, you know, in families with 2 working parents. So it's interesting to me to see that and to see the humor that King injects into the story and to see the new ways that Gerrits kind of is impactful with the emotional parts of the piece. That's interesting to me. And if you don't like it, hey, man, that's great. I'm not going to argue with you and tell you you have to like it. But what I don't understand is why are you buying every single cover? Why are you buying every single issue? If you don't like something, no one's forcing you to buy it. But for you to keep buying it and then complain, and if you feel like you're compelled to buy it because Mr. Miracle is your favorite character, then fine, buy it. But I mean, don't complain about it. The story is what it is. It's interesting. Obviously, there are a lot of people that are enjoying it. That's why it's a best-selling title. I think it's great. I don't always agree and love every single panel of art, you know, but I can appreciate that they're trying something different. And I can appreciate that they do care. Whether you like it or not, you can't say that they don't care. You can't say that Mitch Gerrits is over there saying, yeah, man, I'm just going to repeat the same panel 6 times in a row and be done with this issue in 2 hours and get my paycheck. I promise you he is not thinking that at all. The guy is working hard to create something new, something innovative, and tell a story in a new and unique way. I promise you they care. So sorry to go on a little mini rant there. I wasn't necessarily planning on talking about Mr. Miracle 8, but it just really bugged me that that guy did that. And Mitch Garrett's actually responded to the guy, and he was like, hey, you know, thanks for buying the book, even though you don't like it. Thanks for supporting it. You know, sorry, it's not your cup of tea. And I thought that was real classy of Mitch as well. And I didn't get too wrapped up in the argument myself because, you know, changing somebody's mind on the internet has happened, I think, exactly, let me see, 1, 2, 3. Yeah, never. So I just said, hey, you know, I just find it interesting that if you don't like something, you're still buying it. You know, when I don't like something, I stop buying it. So anyway, that's my 2 cents on that. The other book I'm going to mention is Ninjak versus the Valiant Universe number 4. As a lot of you probably know, we had Aaron Chunky from Bat in the Sun Productions on the podcast this last Sunday to talk about the web series that's coming out on comicbook.com this coming Saturday, April 21st. So this issue, Ninjak vs. the Valiant Universe number 4, wrapped up the storyline in comic book form. I personally can't wait to see the web series. I'm really excited. And I encourage you all, if you didn't hear the Aaron Chunky interview, to go back and listen to it. I love particularly one of the things that he said about how he doesn't like it when directors feel like they have to change costumes and change characters around, because those bright colored costumes and their attitudes and personalities of the heroes don't work on the big screen. It doesn't translate. He's like, man, this is where you're getting your source material from, and you're a director. It's your job to make it work. I love that. I love that this guy cares so much about these comic characters that he wants to be as accurate as possible. And I very much enjoyed the comic series. I thought it was really, really good. And actually, I should probably give the creative team. I don't think I gave the creative team for Mr. Miracle either, but you probably caught on in my rant that it's Tom King and Mitch Gerrards. But the Ninjak versus the Valiant Universe, it's from a story by Aaron Shanka, and it's been adapted by Elliot Rahal. The pencils are by Joe Bennett. The inks are by Bellardino Bravo, and the colors are by Ulysses Areola. So, like I said, it's been a heck of a lot of fun. It's not in continuity as far as the rest of the Valiant Universe. You know, you can just pick up the 4 issues of Ninjak versus the Valiant Universe if you want to just be able to follow along. I think you could probably watch the web series and catch on, but if you want a little more in-depth, you can probably check out the comic. It was a lot of fun. Roku, who a lot of Valiant fans will be familiar with, is kind of the main bad guy, but there's an appearance by one other guy at the very end that's kind of pulling Roku's strings. That was a no particular surprise to me, kind of who I expected it to be. But a lot of action, and I can't wait. I cannot wait to see the web series. If it follows the comic story, which I have no reason to think that it won't, it's pretty much action from start to finish, so I'm really excited for that. So I wanted to be sure and point that out. A few other titles that you may want to be on the lookout for. From Action Lab, we've got Jupiter Jet number 5, written by Jason Immonen and Ashley B. Robinson. I think we'll have Jason on the show soon to talk about Jupiter Jet. So issue 5 wraps up their first volume. So look for that in stores Wednesday. Also from Aftershock, I talked about these on the Aftershock Monday episode. We have Infernal Descent number 1 and Rough Riders Ride or Die number 3. Boom Studios. I want to mention Fence number 5. That's been a really good title that we may do a spotlight on pretty soon. I think it deserves one. It's really good. From DC, in addition to the Action Comics 1000 and the Batman 45, and what else have we talked about? Deadman, we talked about Damage, we talked about Mr. Miracle. Also Superman number 45, just getting ready to wrap up the Peter J. Tomasi and Patrick Gleason run. From IDW, we've got G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero versus $6 Million Man, number 3, which I talked about issue 1 of that a few weeks back. We also have from Image, Curse Words, number 13, from Charles Soule and Ryan Brown. We've got Descender, number 29, from Jeff Lemire and Dustin Nguyen. Kick-Ass, number 3, from Mark Miller and John Romita Jr. Lazarus makes its return this week with number 27. I know a lot of people have been anxiously awaiting that from writer Greg Rucka and artist Michael Lark. We've also got Skyward number one, as I mentioned, book of the week for me. Over at Marvel, quite a few things. And again, apologize for not being able to give more in-depth reviews about some of these Marvel titles. Just for whatever reason, they don't want to send us preview copies. So we're working on it. We're working on it. But Amazing Spider-Man number 799, leading up to 800. And there's rumors that they're going to be introducing a new character. So expect that one. Amazing Spider-Man has been a red hot title. So you probably want to get out there early to your comic shop if you want a copy, because I imagine they're going to sell out relatively quickly. Also, the Avengers No Surrender storyline continues in Avengers 689 from Mark Waid and Jim Zub, with incredible covers by Mark Brooks. Infinity Countdown is number 2 of 5 that's out tomorrow. We've got the Phoenix Resurrection, Return of Jean Grey, a storyline all wrapped up in trade that's coming out tomorrow. And there's a direct market variant with a cover by Art Germ, Stanley Lowell. So I wasn't planning on picking up that trade, but you know, when I get to the comic shop, if they have it there, I'm going to have a hard time turning down that Art Germ cover. And then the last thing I want to mention from Valiant, other than Ninjak versus the Valiant Universe number 4, we also have Quantum and Woody number 5. So, actually, there is one more thing I almost forgot. Wasted Space number 1 from Vault Comics. Really, really great story. It's by Michael Morrissey. He was on about a month ago, maybe a little longer, when the final order cutoff was, or maybe the pre-order cutoff for that title. And we talked about it then. I highly encourage you go back and listen to the interview. It's basically about a guy who was hearing voices and thought he was like a prophet. Cause you know, I mean, what else are you going to think? It's God talking to you, right? And he basically had millions of followers and was like giving advice and steering kind of the future of mankind as we explored the galaxy. And then something went horribly wrong and then everything got blamed on him. And he just wanted to go hide out on the corner of the galaxy and get stoned. And there's something happening. Wheels are turning, political machinations are happening, and it looks like he's getting sucked back in. But when really all the guy really wants to do is be left alone, because he thought he was somebody. He thought he was important. He was a mover and a shaker. You know, he was somebody. And then he really wanted to be nobody. And now it looks like there are people after him, and he may be part of something larger than himself again. So it's a really great story. The art is by Hayden Sherman, who's also doing Cold War for Aftershock right now. So I want to be sure and mention that. That may be one that you may or may not be able to find on the comic racks, just because it's a smaller publisher. But if you don't see it and you want it, just ask your retailer. I'm sure they'll be able to order it for you. So I wanted to be sure and get that in. Is there any other books coming out tomorrow that you want to mention that I didn't touch on, Nick?
No, I haven't really looked at the entire list, honestly. So
you'll get there, my friend. You'll get there.
Yep.
My young Padawan, you will get there. So. All right. Well, once again, we want to thank everyone for joining us. Don't forget, you can go to LRM online for all past episodes of the podcast. Twitter.com/The Comic Source is where you can find us on Twitter. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three places are a great spot to find out when we drop new episodes and follow along with our convention coverage. Also, while you're over at LRM online, be sure and check out all their other coverage of pop culture, TVs, movies, video games, all that kind of good stuff. So thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time.
Bye.